This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The no-confidence vote on campus. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. On this Memorial Day weekend, glad you could spend some time with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
College faculties unhappy with things like cost-cutting proposals are pushing back with votes against school presidents.
The new trend in brewing, finding the weirdest and funkiest yeast. Here where beer makers are looking.
In search of a bargain, three things you can buy for less over the Memorial Day weekend, like gas grills.
And is Shohei Ohtani, as pitcher and hitter, the best baseball player in the world?
Everyone in the baseball community said it can't be done, it wouldn't work, he would eventually give up one or the other depending on which area he showed more proficiency in. And here we are, you know, 6-7 weeks into the season, he has been nothing short of dominant.
Wall Street Journal sports writer Jared Diamond on the season so far for the Angels Japanese sensation. That report in about 20 minutes. It's time for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. In honoring those military members who made the ultimate sacrifice to preserve American freedoms this Memorial Day weekend, take a fresh look at what veterans bring to the table in the workplace and in your community. Are military members stereotyped? Is it assumed that they are broken or have some form of post-traumatic stress? Mike Schindler is CEO of a group called Operation Military Family Cares. He's a veteran of the U.S. Navy, also author of a book called U.S. Veterans in the Workforce. He tries to sell companies on the value of hiring a vet. Mike, what's your message?
Well, the big message for me is there's three things that we need to look at is character, aptitude, and work ethic. And when that veteran comes through your door, those are hopefully the first three things you think about. And not those being PTSD, suicide, and homelessness, which unfortunately tends to be what the general public, the overwhelming idea of what a veteran has seems to be. So we're really working to change that conversation, change that narrative to say, hey, when that person walks through the door, it's character, aptitude, and work ethic. Mm.
How do you change the conversation, by the way?
It's really a boots on ground effort. It is every person that we come across is making sure that we, you know, are a good example, number one. And when people say, you know, we ask a simple question when we're out in the marketplace is, what is the first thing you think of when you hear the word veteran? And we begin that conversation, we open the dialogue to that conversation, and then we just do a slow correct over that period of time. But it really is a boots on ground effort, Gordon.
It seems to require a lot more effort than is necessary, should be necessary.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd love for there to be a national campaign on this. I'd love for there to be, media that says, and there is slowly, you're starting to see it with things like T-Mobile or USAA or some of these where they're starting to showcase the values and the benefits and the positive traits of our military and veteran families. It's really the press, making sure that we work through the press on these type of things so that they start to splash the headlines with these positive attributes.
Mm. There's an interesting point in the notes here talking about how can employers offer better opportunities based on merit. How do you get through that?
Yeah, based on merit. I mean, that's how do you get through that? You know, the biggest challenge that our veterans face today, Gordon, is that they can't get the interview because everything's so automated. And what I would say is when that veteran or when that HR person is looking for the right fit and they see veteran, that they call that person up. And I will tell you in a matter of moments that they'll determine that this is the right person, and it'll be based on merit. It'll be based on, listen, they might not have this certain hard skill that we need, but they certainly have all the soft skills that we need, and we can train up that hard skill. And that, as an employer, having employed many folks over the years, is I look for that over the hard skill because I know that I can train that hard skill.
Yeah. Well, it's like sports, right? Attitude is everything.
You know, it really is. I mean, if somebody's got the right attitude and you know that they've got the work ethic, that the other things can be taught, they can be built in. And that's what we learned in the military, is the only thing standing between me and who I want to be is training. Mm. And if employers take that type of attitude, then they understand that they've got a workforce that will help catapult them to the next level of both morale and profits in their business.
We're speaking with Mike Schindler. He's the CEO of Operation Military Family Cares. He's a U.S. Navy veteran, also author of a book called U.S. Veterans in the Workforce, and we're talking about that subject. You mentioned before that they can't get an interview sometimes, or a lot of the times. Does that mean that the training coming out of the military is not teaching them how to, I don't know, properly send a resume or apply online, or what's happening there? Or is it just bias?
Yeah, I'm probably going to get myself in trouble here, but yeah, there's huge improvement that can be done in the transition, what's called the, you know, the TAP process, Transition Assistance Program. There's a lot of changes that can be made there, but there are some good programs that are coming out that are helping individuals, whether it's Onward to Opportunity, whether it's, you know, VCTP, which is a Veterans Career Transition Program. There's a couple things that Microsoft is doing that are really working to get these guys framed properly so that they can get that interview, but that so that they're skilled in the interview. And there is one program that's emerging out of Microsoft. It's called a master class. It's called a Veterans Master Class. It wasn't developed by Microsoft, but by a gal that used to work there. And it's a great program. It's very, you know, you got to go deep with it. And that's what the men and women have to understand, is it really is a training program. They have a graduation rate of close to 100% and a hire rate of close to 80%.
Wow.
And so there's some big changes that are happening, and that is outside of the Transition Assistance Program. So it's unfortunate that the military can't properly train them out. They train us really good coming in, not so great coming out. But in many ways, that ought to be left to corporate, because corporate knows what they need.
Yeah.
And so you're starting to see some shifts there.
Thanks, Mike. Mike Schindler from Operation Military Family Cares. Again, his book is called U.S. Veterans in the Workforce. It's 13 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Hey, Kletch could be with us. In a sign of the changes roiling academia, faculties are voting no confidence in university and college presidents a lot more regularly than years ago. What's going on? Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
It's a sign of the times. Faculties are voting no confidence in university and college presidents 4 times more frequently than a decade ago. Douglas Belkin of the Wall Street Journal has written about this trend and joins us now. Doug, your story outlines a situation that occurred last year at Rider University here in New Jersey. What happened there?
A new president came in 2015 and looked at the books, and they were running about a $7 million operating deficit. So he had to figure out a way to come up with the money. So he suggested trying to get rid of a bunch of majors at the school. The faculty pushed back. He rescinded the strategy in lieu of trying to sell a music college instead. But the faculty was still not happy about it, and so they voted to have no confidence in him, to try to force him out, try to get the Board of Trustees to get rid of him.
Now, why is this happening elsewhere?
So the business model of a lot of colleges and universities is under tremendous pressure right now. The enrollment around the country, especially at sort of mid-tier private schools, is really under fire, under siege. Most of these schools are tuition-dependent, and if they can't fill their classes, it means they don't have enough paying customers to pay their staff, to keep up with their building, their maintenance. Colleges have a lot of expenses. So more and more presidents have to come in and try to figure out ways to either generate new revenue by increasing enrollment or doing some other sort of sales, or by cutting costs. And the faculty that is, you know, usually been there a lot longer than a president, pushes back. They have the right, they have under shared governance, they have the ability to make their ire known, and so this is happening around the country at a faster rate.
Douglas, is it happening with maybe one or two professors starting a movement and having it spread? How is it actually happening on campuses?
It really varies school to school, but the general idea is that if a president says we've got to get rid of X and Y major, the faculty frequently sort of locks their arms, circles their wagons, and says, well, we've got to protect this department because my department may be next. So there's a lot of cohesion among the faculty. There's often faculty unions and such that that you know, come together to try to protect themselves and one another. So there's a sort of sense that attack on one is an attack on all and needs to be fought back. And so these votes tend to go, they tend to win when one comes up.
We're speaking with Douglas Belkin of the Wall Street Journal. Is it all about money, or are there other issues that professors are speaking out about?
Money's the root of most of this stuff, but you know what it takes to get kids to enroll at a university and why they should come to the university is a question that people have different opinions on. So, you know, the humanities may not be selling as in terms of majors for kids. But a school with a long tradition of liberal arts may be loath to give up a German department or a philosophy department in lieu of a computer science department. So, you know, the sort of identity of schools are in place, are at play here, and what an education means in America, or what a diploma from a specific university means, is also part of the debate.
Doug, do we know what kind of an impact these disputes have on a school and or the students at the school?
They make things uncomfortable for a while. You know, faculty is obviously a really important presence on a campus. If they're not happy with the president, then they make that displeasure gets known. They do not have legal authority to force a president out. That comes only from the Board of Trustees. But the Board of Trustees tends to listen over the long term to faculty. They're, you know, critical, and a lot of them are tenured, so they can't get rid of them. They have to live with them. So the more than half of the presidents who are the target of a vote of no confidence are gone within a couple of years. Although frequently when they leave, you know, it's they're off to spend more time with their family, that sort of thing. So it's hard to know exactly how many are tied to the votes and how many are disconnected.
But it seems that sometimes the tact that the faculty are using are working.
Yeah, the faculty have leverage, and they're not afraid to use it.
Wall Street Journal higher education writer Doug Belkin with this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Is Shohei Ohtani the best baseball player in the world? Take all the best skills of the sport's most elite players, wrap them into one freakish athlete, and you end up with Ohtani. Veteran Logan Morrison, whose Minnesota Twins whiffed 11 times in 6 1/3 innings against Ohtani recently, put it this way: with what he does on the mound and with the bat, he's probably the best player in the world. More from Wall Street Journal national baseball writer Jared Diamond. Jared, tell us about him.
Shohei Ohtani has done already more than I think anyone ever could have imagined. He came over from Japan, signed with the Angels with a ton of hype. This is a guy that was going to be the first player in a century to try to be a two-way player, to be an everyday position player or hitter, and a regular member of the starting rotation at the same time. Pretty much everyone in the baseball community said it can't be done, it wouldn't work. He would eventually give up one or the other, depending on which area he showed more proficiency in. And here we are, you know, 6-7 weeks into the season, he has been nothing short of dominant on both sides of the ball, and it's really turned him into a phenomenon. It's one of the best stories baseball has seen in a really long time.
Good thing they gave him a shot after a so-so spring training at best, right?
He was terrible in spring training. He was so dismal that there was people speculating that maybe this guy should start in the minor leagues. He's not a good pitcher or a hitter. It's amazing how quickly the switch turned on the second the season started. His spring training for him was terrible, but the Angels really had no choice. It was clear. It was made clear that he was only going to sign with a team coming from Japan, a team that allowed him to try to do both. It was something he was committed to. He was not coming to Major League Baseball from Japan if not for the opportunity to do both. And so the Angels kind of had no choice but at least let him try. But the thought was, okay, they'll give it a few months, and then when it doesn't work, they'll start sort of asserting their will on him and tell him what they want him to do. But right now, there's no reason to change anything. In fact, if anything, they're trying to figure out how they could get him into the game more.
So put in perspective some of the numbers that you cited in the story.
We took a look at where he ranks statistically, sort of compared to some of the other best players in the major leagues, just based on individual tools, individual skills. So we looked at things like how hard he hits the ball, how hard he throws his fastball, how fast he runs, all this data that is available to us thanks to tools like Major League Baseball StatCast, which basically measures everything that you could possibly measure. And we showed that he ranks right up there with the best players in all of baseball in some of these categories. For instance, his average fastball this season has been 97 miles an hour. There's only two starting pitchers in baseball that throw fastballs that hard, Noah Syndergaard and Luis Severino, who are two of the best pitchers in the sport. You know, in terms of how hard he hits the ball, his average this season has been about 94 miles an hour off the bat. Again, that ranks up with Aaron Judge, who last season led Major League Baseball with an exit velocity of 94.9 miles an hour. So it just sort of shows just how unique and special this guy is. There's nobody in baseball, really no one in baseball history, who has this many tools all in one person.
It's stunning. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal national baseball writer Jared Diamond. He's written a piece called The Best Player in the World, Inside Shohei Ohtani's Unmatched Skills. But there are still four more full months of the season to go. Anybody doubting whether or not he can keep up the pace?
Well, that's the big question. That's the question the Angels are constantly wrestling with, which is, how do we keep him fresh? How much can we use him? How do we maintain his schedule? So far, it's worked out well. He's pitched once a week, roughly, which instead of once every 5 days, they've had him pitch once a week. He has not played in the field. They've only used him as a designated hitter. He doesn't hit the day he pitches, the day before he pitches, or the day after he pitches. So they're giving him a lot of rest. The question is, can this sort of continue? Could they add to his workload? I think it's sort of unclear right now. I think right now the Angels are saying this is working. Let's just stick with it and not, you know, touch it.
Thanks, Jared. That's Wall Street Journal national baseball writer Jared Diamond. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org. Thanks for spending part of your Memorial Day weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka coming up this half hour. Why a good number of us won't go on vacation this summer. Also, the newest thing in beer, making something, a product with ancient yeast, and things you can buy for less on Memorial Day weekend. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Ever worry that you've lost your inner compass, literally, because you're addicted to GPS? USA Today's digital life columnist Stephen Petro was concerned. That's why he said no to the navigation option on his new car a year ago. He says he'd become that person who never looked at maps and just drove like a zombie from here to there. Stephen, what do you mean?
I had found, like many people, that I was relying on GPS to go everywhere. And what that meant was I really didn't know how to get anywhere. You know, your brain kind of gets very lazy, and you just listen to the directions, and you go from A to B, and then you're there. But I could never repeat any of those trips. And so I had this very telling moment when I was in Los Angeles earlier in the year, and my iPhone, which is, like for many people, the backup to everything, has the maps on it, it has Uber, it went dead all of a sudden. And I couldn't get anywhere. I didn't have the phone number of the friend I was visiting in my head, right, in my phone. I couldn't reach him. I couldn't use the phone to get an Uber, to get a taxi. There were no maps available to me. And so I said, it's time for a little renavigation here. And I have started eschewing the GPS and using, you know, I hate to say it, paper fold-out maps, you know?
Yep.
Do you remember those, Gordon?
Yes, and I love them. And, you know, to your point, I feel like sometimes I do the same thing. Like if I'm on a, you know, traveling to a soccer game with my son or something, I abandon all common sense when my GPS is on my phone. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, we're like these automatons that, you know, we just listen to the disembodied voice comes out of our car, and, you know, we, you know, 600 feet, you know, make a right, make a left, so on and so forth. So what I have found is by looking at the map, I get a much better sense of sort of what's called cognitive mapping, you know, where I'm going. So gee, I'm at the beach right now as I'm talking to you. I drove about 200 miles east to the ocean, you know. And some people might not even know that the Atlantic Ocean is to the east or, you know, where north is.
Right,
we need to orient ourselves a little bit more in the world, you know. Where's the church? Where's the lake? It'll give us reference points so that we're a little bit more connected. And we're using our minds to travel, you know, not the machine. You know, there's that old kind of saying, you know, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. And I think more than anything, that is true here. It's about how we travel, how we get to where we're going.
What is that? What was the, I think it was a professor at Temple University who weighed on this. What was her take?
You know, basically her take, Nora Newcomb, was that we, by not using the cognitive mapping facilities in our brain, they're atrophying. And what's really dangerous about that, there seems to be some, I'm going to say, association, not causation,
okay,
with dementia and Alzheimer's.
Wow.
By losing those faculties. So it's kind of important to exercise your brain with its cognitive mapping features. And I'm sure folks like Professor Newcomb will be learning more about that as days go by and weeks go by. But, you know, that's another reason for relying on paper. I will just tell you a funny story, though. You know, being of a certain age where my eyesight is not perfect anymore, and so it was dusk, and I was relying on the map and couldn't see it so well because I couldn't expand it with my fingers, and I did have to go back to the iPhone for a moment to actually see where I was because I was lost and I couldn't find my way. So, you know, there's not always a perfect solution. It's probably good to have backups of each, traditional and digital.
Yeah. I was going to say, there are millennials who are listening to this saying, how can we test out that alternative universe if we wanted to, Uncle Steven, for just a moment? What would we do?
Well, you know, this is a little bit ironic, but I have gone to MapQuest. I have printed out the map and the directions. You know, it's sort of the best of both worlds, but that's how those millennials could do it. They can also go into, a Rand McNally store. If they don't want to go to a store because that's the 20th century, they can go online and, you know, buy a map from Amazon. It's possible. And then, of course, we'll just argue with our driving companions, no, you were supposed to go west there.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're missing all that fun, Gordon.
Steven Petro, columnist at USA Today. The column is called Digital Life. It's 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend part of your holiday weekend with us. Millions of Americans will be sitting at home this summer, unable to afford a vacation. If the economy is humming along, what's the problem? Amanda Dixon, analyst at Bankrate.com, has a look at their new survey. Amanda, what have you found?
Our survey found that nearly one in four Americans say that they actually can't afford to go on vacation this summer, and that's why they're planning to not go on vacation. And besides cost, other issues keeping people from taking time off are having too many family obligations and simply being too busy at work.
Wow. That's not good if you're too busy at work. I mean, you got to get away.
Definitely. I would say that if you have paid vacation days, you should definitely take advantage of them, you know, at least to give yourself a chance to recharge.
Yeah. Does this break down at all by age?
Yes, actually, millennials are more likely to say that they're not taking time off because they can't afford it or they have too much going on at work. Gen Xers and baby boomers are more likely to say that they're not taking time off because of family obligations rather than workload.
Wow. Have any feel for how these numbers may differ from years past? Like, are we less likely to take vacation these days than we were before? Is it getting worse?
Well, this is actually the first time that we've looked at this particular study, but what we have found is that there is a trend in that Americans who get paid time off are not taking advantage of that time.
Wow. All right. So for those who do go on vacation, what do they spend?
the median amount that people are planning to spend this summer is about $1,000. Millennials are more likely to spend that amount or less, and older people are more likely to spend more than $2,000 this summer.
Well, I guess possibly they have more disposable income, right, at this point of their lives. Maybe millennials saddled with debt or whatever.
Absolutely. Those are definitely what I would say.
We're speaking with Amanda Dixon, analyst at Bankrate.com. They've got a new survey about summer vacations. What else jumped out at you here?
What jumped out at me is the fact that, as I said, the median amount that people are planning to spend is $1,000. But we did a survey earlier this year that found that most people don't have enough savings to cover a $1,000 emergency. So for some people, they might want to reevaluate whether going on vacation is a good idea, especially if they don't have enough savings for a rainy day.
Jeez. Well, at least do a staycation, right? At least decompress at home if you're not going anywhere.
Exactly. I would recommend that, you know, try to stay close to home. It's a great way to save money.
Yeah. Your notes, too, said that folks in the Northeast are more likely to spend above the median than other regions on vacation.
That's true. Folks in the Northeast, or the median amount that they're planning to spend is about $1,500. And overall, the median amount that people are planning to spend is $1,000.
Wow. Any reason why?
I would say cost of living, especially being here in New York City, it's a lot more expensive than it is. I'm from Georgia, and it's definitely cheaper to live down there. So I would say,
right.
You know, it's more expensive up here, and so people are, you know, used to spending more money.
Thanks, Amanda. Amanda Dixon, analyst at Bankrate.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. There's a brewing movement in the beer world trying to find the weirdest, funkiest yeast. Small beer makers and even global drinks companies are entering the contest, hoping new and exclusive brews with a story behind them will entice consumers who are increasingly migrating to wine and spirits. But Wall Street Journal reporter Mike Cherney says finding new yeasts and successfully using them in a modern brewery can take years of work, and there's no guarantee of success. Mike, explain.
It just seems from my reporting that, you know, more people were doing this recently, given the craft beer trend that's taking place in the U.S. All these beer makers are basically trying to make their beer stand out among, you know, all the new ones that are on the shelves. So people really need to, make their beer, you know, appeal to customers and find a way to stand out.
How do you search for ancient yeast?
Yeah, well, so this one guy that I talked to, who was quoted in the beginning of the story, basically just goes around in the forest and grabs branches and lichen and other things and basically puts it in a jar of a sugary sort of solution, which is basically unfermented beer, and just kind of sees if anything sort of develops. So that's one way you can do it. You can literally just walk through the forest and see what you can collect. The other anecdote in the story involved a brewery in Australia, and they had worked with a museum that had some old bottles from a shipwreck, and they had actually been able to take some yeast out of one of those old bottles and eventually use that in their beer. So there's several different ways that you can go about doing this.
So, and when they find it, let's say, are they then trying to recreate it or grow it? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, so I believe the way that it works is that some of the yeast can survive in a bottle that's, you know, 200 years old or so, and they can take that into a lab and then basically get it to start reproducing and create, you know, new yeast cultures pretty much. So it's not like you're taking the actual, you know, necessarily actual yeast cell from the bottle. From the old bottle and putting it in all this new beer. You're basically taking it and then regrowing it with the same strain, if that makes any sense.
Oh, that's something. Wow. So how many different types of strains of yeast might there be?
Well, there's definitely a lot. This one organization in England selects yeast cultures their latest count was over 4,000 different strains, and that includes brewing yeast as well as baking yeast and other types of yeast. So that's just one number. So we're talking thousands, possibly more.
Wow. Thanks, Mike. It's Wall Street Journal reporter Mike Cherney, who's based in Sydney, Australia. The picture that accompanies his story shows like a guy in sort of a scuba or snorkeling gear, and he's holding some bottle. Looks like he's at the bottom of the sea somewhere. It is 6 minutes now, rather, in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your Memorial Day weekend with us. What items can you get great deals on at Memorial Day sales? USA Today put together a guide. One, big ticket items. Appliances, furniture, mattresses, home improvement items, and grills tend to be discounted for Memorial Day. Keep an eye on places like Wayfair, Sears, JCPenney, and Lowe's. Some sales have already begun. For example, at Kmart, all Serta mattresses are on sale through May 28. Sears is taking 50% off the regular price of Kenmore Elite washer and dryer pairs through June 3rd. Number two, off-season staples. Pay attention to seasonality. Inventory may be picked over, but Memorial Day sales will offer great deals on winter closeout items. For example, buy Christmas gifts during Memorial Day sales and tuck them away. And number three, meals, paint, and more for military members and vets. For example, steakhouse chain Texas Day Brazil will give veterans and active duty military 50% off lunch or dinner on Memorial Day. Sherwin-Williams is offering military and veterans 10% savings on qualifying paints and stains during the month of May. At Academy Sports and Outdoor Stores, military members can take 10% off through May 29. Check with each location, of course, for exclusions. For Jennifer Kashenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.